Podcast. Thank you for having me, Joe.
Hi, welcome to the podcast. I am Joe Posnanski, and with me is Michael Shore. Michael, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Joe.
You're welcome. You are so welcome. Happy Martin Luther King Day.
Yes, to you too.
Is that nice. How you're supposed to do it? Is that what you're supposed to, like, I mean, like some days, like Happy Veterans Day, you don't really say that, right? I mean, that doesn't sound, maybe Veterans Day you would, I guess. I don't know.
I think you can say that. I think you can say happy any holiday kind of, can't you? Am I crazy?
Well, I mean, but summer obviously more sober, I mean, like Veterans Day. I mean, obviously right. We're there to celebrate our veterans, but also to think about our lost veterans and all of that. And
someone should make a list of the proper, in the same way that like there are lists of proper honorifics to address different people, ambassadors and presidents and prime ministers and stuff. There
sure.
should be a list of proper exhortations per holiday. So perhaps the proper one for Veterans Day would be to greet someone by saying, "Hey, Contemplative Veterans Day," or something, right? Like whatever. It is, like you don't want to say happy because it's not a happy occasion, but you want to say like a, you know, maybe it would be like a warm Arbor Day, or you know what I mean. We should make up this list of like what's the proper exhortation that matches each holiday's tone and purpose.
Well, I think it goes without saying we don't do politics here on the podcast. However, I think we both noticed that this has been a very contemplative MLK day for Paul Ryan.
There's a lot of people are contemplative today, but none more so than Speaker of the House Paul Ryan, who posted a picture of himself in what I can only describe as a cartoon contemplative pose, where he's staring at a bust of Martin Luther King Jr. and his hand is literally cupping his chin.
He's stroking
in the way that cartoon characters think about things. They stroke their chins. That's what Paul Ryan is doing. It's amazing. I invite all of you to check it out if you haven't already.
It is the most. The thing I thought when I saw that, other than your point, was how did this happen? How did anybody allow this to happen?
That's right.
How did anybody working with him, who knows him, any friend of his, allow him to do this to himself? But my first thought was, how many photos did they take to get exactly the right contemplative? Clearly, that was not the first photo. Clearly, he's like, no, I'm not contemplative enough.
I don't know. It's a good question. Although I would venture to say it's also likely that they were just like rushing through the halls of the Capitol or wherever they were. And then he was like, oh, hang on real quick. Just get a shot of me staring contemplatively at Martin Luther King, because it's Martin Luther King Day. And then he posed and they went click and he went, okay, now let's go quickly.
We got it. Let's go. I'll put that up on Twitter later.
Yeah. Just throw it up there and say, quote, letter from a Birmingham jail or something. Just quick. Hurry up.
All right. Two things. We are actually doing our, what has become sort of a classic, the podcast Baseball Hall of Fame rundown, where we go through the entire ballot for your entertainment and education. But there are two things I want to say. One, this is sort of a personal thing, but you probably feel the same way. Big bummer with us losing Dolores O'Riordan, the lead singer of the Cranberries, died earlier today. Big Cranberries fan. It was a bummer. I just thought that was a
awful.
Real bummer. Just awful.
Deeply awful. And in a world of like where, you know, massive swaths of music can sound the same.
Yes.
You always knew a Cranberry song the second she started singing. She had I would say, the most distinctive voice in rock music of her entire era. And those songs, the Cranberries were great. And one of the reasons they're great is that you know more Cranberry songs than you think you do. Even if you're not a fan.
Exactly right.
There are probably nine Cranberry songs that you know very well and know a lot of the words to, even if you don't know that you know them. And it's because they were so good and she was such a wonderful singer. That was a real awful blow to have to read about.
That was a real bummer. I saw them in concert. It's Aurora O'Riordan, by the way. I totally mispronounced that before, which is sad. Saw them in concert. Seen them in concert. I saw the Sundays in concert. You know, they came out around the same time. Both sheer delight. Just delightful, wonderful bands. But boy, the Cranberries, that was a joyous concert to go to. There's just their music is just joyous. So very, very sad. The second thing I wanted to discuss before we get to our Hall of Fame ballot is, and this is more of a specific question to you. This is your question.
Okay.
As I'm sure our listeners know, even though we are not big NFL fans, we are aware that this weekend coming up, your New England Patriots are back for the, I think, 73rd straight year, right? 73rd
That's
straight
right.
year.
73 AFC straight now, AFC Championship runs, right. Yeah.
That's right. And they are playing the stunningly so, the previously 3-13 Jacksonville Jaguars in the AFC Championship game. That's what they were last year, 3-13. So that's
right.
Amazing, just amazing. And in addition to this, the Jacksonville Jaguars have played a very big role on your television show, The Good
Place. That's right.
And continue to. And just saw, by the way, the episode, recently episode that I'm not gonna spoil for anybody who hasn't seen it, but there is particular Jacksonville Jaguar joy in this one. I assume there's more to come.
Oh, there's more coming, yeah.
Which is wonderful. Earlier this year, I guess it was late last year, I guess if you think about it, but less than a year ago, you were put in a weird position where, because of your jerk son, you would have rooted somewhat against your Boston Red Sox if they had played the Dodgers in the World Series. So the question for you to take the stage is there even a small part of you that is rooting for the underdog, super cool Blake Bortles run Jacksonville Jaguars against your grotesque, over like everything, super successful New England Patriots?
Oh, I want the Jags to win straight up.
There it is. I was thinking and hoping that's what you were going to say.
Yes. No, 100%. So just to clarify. So when I said that I would take the position of rooting for the Dodgers because of my jerk son over the Red Sox, what that means is outwardly I would root for the Dodgers, but in my soul, I will never root for any team other than the Red Sox. Like, I just can't. It's just impossible. Now, that generally speaking is true. My New England tribalism runs pretty strong. I spent my entire life there. My allegiances were formed very early. They were only strengthened through bitter, miserable failure repeatedly over and over again in every sport except basketball. But when it comes to football, like, there's a couple of things that are different about the football. Number one is my general loss of interest in NFL football. That's one. Number two, the fact that my team wins the Super Bowl every year.
It does play a role. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I think, you know, so yesterday was the first day I've watched football, a full day of football. I watched both games almost in their entireties, I would say. So we watched the Jaguars play the Steelers, and that was a pretty entertaining game, although kind of it was just weird. It felt
weird.
It was weird, and I didn't like it, and it was strange. And I mean, it's exciting to see any underdog beat a heavily favored team. And obviously, like, you know, the Steelers, everybody in the world thought the Steelers were going to play the Patriots next week. And so it was interesting to watch that narrative fall apart. And also it's just very funny. It's just extremely funny that Blake Bortles and the Jacksonville Jaguars are playing the AFC Championship game.
Yes, it is.
You know, look, Blake Bortles is a frequent target of humor on The Good Place. One of the characters in the show is from Jacksonville, loves the Jaguars, and is constantly just yelling out Blake Bortles' name all the time. And but the truth is, the reason that it's funny, 50% of the reason it's funny, is because the name Blake Bortles is just funny.
It's a funny name.
When you actually, I had never watched them play, but when I actually watched them play, I was like, oh, I've seen this. I know this. We all know this before. This is the Mark Sanchez Jets. This is the Trent Dilfer Buccaneers. This is the, like, you know, this is the Joe Flacco Ravens, even to some extent, where, like, the defense of the team is so good And the quarterback is not good, but good enough to hand off to a running back who gains 140 yards and good enough to like hit a like a. I mean, that the best pass he made yesterday was the little sort of floater down the middle for the touchdown to the fullback who had gone to block for Fournette and then just released up the seam. And he just floated. I mean, it was a throw I could make. It was just a throw. He threw the ball straight forward about 15 yards and the guy caught it for a touchdown. But it was a good throw.
It was a good NFL throw.
And I was like, yeah, that's what Flacco did. That's what Trent Dilfer did. That's what Mark Sanchez could do from time to time. Like, we've seen this. This is not a new phenomenon. This is an otherworldly defense with shutdown corners and hard-hitting safeties and great like linebackers who flow in the right direction on running plays and Calais Campbell on the defensive line just like taking up three-fourths of the space that's available to a running back. So I was like, oh, okay, now I get what this team is, right? So I was happy that they won, and I mean, there are many, many, many reasons to root for them over New England. The only thing that's making me at all root for New England is just tribalism.
Sure.
But the Jag, I am anti-NFL now. I want the league to just burn to the ground, basically. And if you really think about it, like, the best way to accomplish that is to have the Jaguars defeat the Philadelphia Eagles. My official prediction is they're going to defeat the Eagles 8-3.
8-3.
They're going to score 8 points on 4 safeties. Blake Bortles will be something like 3 of 17 for 28 yards and 3 picks.
Right.
Nick Foles will be 9 of 38 for 18 yards and 11 picks. And the game by the end, like, half of the stadium will just be empty. It'll be like a preseason game, and the ratings will be terrible. And by the time Roger Goodell gives the trophy to the owner of the Jacksonville Jaguars, who, by the way, is a Pakistani born gentleman, which would be exciting. Yes. I would really like to see that happen just for the optics of it, I think would be wonderful. By the time that happens, it'll be an empty stadium. Like, Goodell's voice will be just echoing through an empty stadium because the game will have just been terrible for so long. And that's I'm actively rooting for that. The Patriots have won 5 Super Bowls. They've been to 2 others. The actual fact is, I believe this is their 7th consecutive AFC championship game. I mean, it's just absurd. Like, what more can you want if you're a Patriots fan? It just feels absurd at this point. And I think that they're the only narrative anybody can find really is like, well, if Brady wins 6, then it'll be like Jordan or whatever. Like, he'll get to that. Somehow 6 is the magic number when it because it just, of Jordan. It's like, that's up. Yeah. I don't know. But I want the Jaguars to win. It would be very good for my desire to watch the NFL crumble, and it would be very good for my TV show.
Yes, that's right. And it would be very funny. I obviously have no allegiance whatsoever to the Patriots, so it's a slam dunk for me.
Sure.
I clearly want the Jaguars to win. Here's what I will say about football, and then we really do need to get to the ballot because there are a lot of names on there. But this is what I will say about football. So yesterday I did watch. I didn't watch all of it. To be honest, I kind of gave up on that Vikings game at halftime, which was a mistake. Then came back to it very, very late, which was cool because I got to see the ending. But it was, I watched quite a bit. And here's the thing. I didn't care. I really didn't care. I mean, I wanted the Jaguars to win because I think they're funny, and I think that defense really is awesome. And I think Brad Johnson, I mean, Blake Bortles, whichever one he is fine. You know, that narrative is very fun. However, it is impossible to watch the NFL without having 2 thoughts. And this is, all I did was watch Browns games this year. These playoff games are the only non-Browns games I've seen all year. So I'm completely out of the NFL mix. And yet, as soon as I come back to it, I'm reminded you cannot watch the NFL without thinking 2 things. One, it is impossible to officiate an NFL football game, and I hate watching these replay fiascos. I can't tolerate them. I don't care. It's so frustrating to watch them turn what is just pointless into the most important thing on planet Earth. And I look, if it's a game deciding play, I get it, but these stoppages in the middle of the second quarter for nothing. It just drives me insane. So that's the first thing. But the second thing is, and this was something you and I could not help ourselves. This is what I mean about the NFL. We cannot help ourselves. We had like a 20 text exchange about how idiotic the Steelers coaching was. Ooh. Regarding the clock, right? Ooh. I mean, it was really regarding everything, including pitch plays on fourth and inches and just bizarre. I have no idea what the heck happened there. It's like the whole coaching staff kind of lost their minds all at once. But to me, it all comes down to, speaking of meaningless, with 2:16 left in the game, the Steelers tried an onside kick, which was absolutely the wrong decision. 100%. There was never a doubt. They had two timeouts and the two-minute warning. Your defense has to stop them. And you could say, well, their defense didn't stop them all day. That's fine. If your defense can't stop them, you'll lose. That's how it works. But you kick the onside kick, you have a 1 in what, 30 chance to get it, maybe? They haven't recovered an onside kick since 2007. So you're almost certainly not going to get the ball that way. And they had, by the way, one of the worst onside kicks I've ever seen. You see it hit the guy like running. It hit a guy like 4 yards downfield. I mean, it was terrible.
Yeah.
But then he did something that is meaningless, that's absolutely meaningless, but still drove me insane. So 2:16 left. Jaguars have the ball almost in field goal range. The game is basically over. Your only hope is you stop them, 3 quick plays. They miss the field goal or somehow you get a negative play and they're out of field goal range or something. So they run the first ball and they gain a couple of yards and they don't call timeout. Right. And they let the clock run all the way down to the 2-minute warning for no reason. Absolutely no reason. And I just thought, you know what? You don't deserve to win. If you don't know the basic math of not letting the clock run down to the 2-minute warning when you have 2 timeouts left, why would you do that? Why? It was insane.
And it wasn't the clock was at 2:02. It was like 2:12 or 2:11. Right. They lost. I mean, think about it. Let's say they call that timeout and let's say there's 2:11 left on the clock. Right. Then the Jaguars run the ball again and they call their second timeout. Now there's 2:06 left on the clock.
That's right.
Now one of two things happens. The Jaguars run again. If you stop them, it stops at the 2-minute warning. So you are getting a punt from their, you know, whatever, wherever they were at the time. You're getting a punt that takes place at the 2-minute warning. And you have Ben Roethlisberger and Antonio Brown and Le'Veon Bell. You have 2 minutes. You can go. You can drive the length of the field 40 times in 2 minutes with those guys. And instead, you just for no reason just conceded 12 seconds. And I thought of it. I thought of it many times when it was happening. I thought of it again when Stephon Diggs ran across the goal line with the improbable winning touchdown in the Vikings game because he crossed the goal line as the clock hit 0. And really, in those scenarios, every second matters. If they had had, you know, they threw that pass with 10 seconds left. In that Vikings game, and like that's fewer seconds than 12 seconds. So if they had made a similar mistake and had lost 12 seconds of time, like, well, now it's so crazy. Like they still don't know how to do it. And that in that game, the first 4th and inches, they ran a play which involved throwing the ball backwards 6 yards. That doesn't make any sense. The next play, they pretended to give it to the best running back in football and threw like a 20-yard downfield pass to like a tight end who was in tight coverage. That didn't make any sense. They didn't call the timeouts. They also they kicked an onside kick 4 yards directly sideways and lost the ball, which led directly to a field goal. They were down 7 at the time. That led to a field goal that essentially put the game out of reach. Then when they got the ball, into field goal range with like 30 seconds left.
Yes.
And then there was a penalty. And then it's like, oh, this is the most obvious thing in the world. You need 10 points. Kick the field goal immediately. Right. And because you have to score twice anyway. So just take the field goal. And then you have to kick an onside kick again, man. So and instead they chipped away and chipped away and chipped away and ended up scoring a touchdown with 1 second on the clock, which means that nothing good can happen. So like it was like Mike Tomlin, I think he always seems like such a good coach and his players sure seem to love him. And he's had a lot of success and they make the playoffs every year and all that sort of stuff. But boy, oh boy. I mean, those are, there were at least four just utterly indefensible decisions in that game. And, you know, it's easy to obviously be a literally a Monday morning quarterback and say, why didn't Ben Roethlisberger just take he weighs 300 pounds, just jump straight forward and get like, or hand to your fullback or something. And it's easy to say that. And we're not facing the Jaguars defensive line and we're not facing Calais Campbell and whatever. But like, I mean, isn't that a better play than throwing the ball 6 yards backwards? Oh. I don't understand it. Like the one thing that you know about the Jaguars defense is they're incredibly fast. Every single guy on that team, every linebacker, every safety, every corner, like throwing a ball 6 yards backwards when you need 1 inch seems like a really bad idea, even if it's Le'Veon Bell. I feel like they just kind of blew it, man. I can't escape the idea that is in my head that the Steelers coaching staff blew that game for them.
Totally did. There's no argument. And by the way, the not kicking the field goal when they're in field goal range, like immediately, because they got it down there with like 40, maybe 40 seconds.
Yeah, left. There was a decent number of seconds left at the moment that I thought, oh, they could kick right here. Like there were
And they were at the four, and it was like, all right, well, are you going to, the feeling always is, well, you're that close to the end zone, you might as well try to score in the end zone. The only thing that matters there is time. The only thing that matters there is time.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah, maybe on the first play, it'll take you 5 seconds, you'll score. As it turned out, you're playing a really good defense. They got him in his grasp. He illegally grounded the ball, and that's a 10-second runoff, and then it was over. Nobody really seems to play the math except Bill Belichick. Like
that's right.
That's why his team always wins. You know?
That's right.
It's because he actually does these things. All right, enough football. It is time for our annual going through the Baseball Hall of Fame ballot. And I guess to start, I will ask you, are you taking on a persona this year or are you just going straight on this one?
No, I'm taking on a persona, and the persona is guy who doesn't do any research but has very strong opinions about things based on literally nothing. That's my persona.
I like it. So this is guy who just feels very strongly about stuff without knowing a thing.
Guy just super, super confident in my own opinions based on zero research without any effort to improve myself by learning things about the world I live in.
I want to make a point very quickly. I've written about every one of these people on the ballot. They've been running every single day. This is I think the third or fourth straight year I've done this series where I run this, and it's wonderful. And I get such great feedback and people are terrific about it. It's great. However, I get a lot of feedback from people who will say things to me that are in the story. Like they'll say like, oh, you know, really, look, I don't know how you missed this, but you should have compared him to this guy. When in the story, I have compared him to that guy.
Right.
And I just think that's annoying. That's the one sort of annoying thing. So if you want to do that a few times, that would be.
Oh, listen, what's going to happen is I'm going to make a lot of statements that are going to end up being false because, again, I've done no research, but I'm going to assert them all as true. I'm going to make a lot of wild claims and accusations.
Sure.
There's no science behind what I'm doing at all. There's no research. I can't emphasize that enough. I'm going to very, very boldly state that certain players have accomplished certain things when I absolutely don't know whether they accomplished those things. And I'm not going to look it up. And I'm going to form opinions based on nothing more than my own bluster and self-confidence.
All right. This is
going
to be great.
This is called the full, I'm going full Bayless. That's what I'm doing.
doing the full Bayless. I love this.
I'm doing a full Bayless on this. Yeah.
All right. Let's start. We're going to start with some of the newcomers. And I'm just going to throw them out. And a couple of them I'm going to throw out in pairs just to give you the opportunity to make comparisons. So I'm going to mention a couple of relievers to start with, Brad Lidge and Jason Isringhausen.
Great. Very clear here. Lidge, Hall of Famer, Isringhausen, not. Lidge, one of the most feared relievers in baseball.
He was feared.
That's why he gets him. One of the most feared. Threw so hard, nobody wanted to face this guy.
Right.
He had 225 saves. I mean, think about that for a second. That's top five in history. 225 saves. There's almost no one. I think only four people have more.
Maybe four or five.
Eight. he threw 600 innings, had 800 strikeouts. I mean, that's easily one of the best ratios in history. No question. I remember very vaguely he gave up a big home run in some playoff game. I'm gonna just ignore that. I'm gonna discount that. That doesn't matter. That's a small sample size. Hall of Famer, Brad Lidge, Hall of Famer. Isringhausen, no, too many injuries. That's the thing with Isringhausen.
Lots of injuries.
Too many injuries. He was a starter and a closer, so we get some points for that. I remember when he came up, there was a lot of talk about it, him and Bill Pulsifer, right? Yep. And rescuing the Mets. And they, you know, it was like, oh, this is the future. Never really panned out, that guy. So they kind of fell apart. Too many injuries. So, no, he doesn't get in.
I think that's fair. Brett Lidge is one of the weirder careers in that when he was good, man, he was really good. When he was bad, though, like, I mean, he to me is like the closest reliever there is to Roy Hobbs. Like there was like whenever the woman in white stood up, he was like unhittable. Like, do you remember? He was like completely done. He was completely closed. And then he went to the Phillies and like almost won the MVP award just out of kind of like, what? Like, I thought he was done. And, you know, he was incredible. Then he gave up the Pujols home run that you mentioned, sort of.
Right.
And then he was terrible. Then he was just like, he couldn't get anybody out. Then he went to the Phillies and he was like, oh my gosh, he's back. He's incredible. He's great. And then, sort of the opposite of that. He was terrible the next year. Just weird. Just a weird career. Isringhausen, whatever. I mean, he's you know, Isringhausen had, by the way, here's one that if you had known this, you would have used it. Same number of saves as Hall of Famer Bruce Sutter.
Oh man, I wish I had done research. That would have really bolstered my, or I guess it contradicted my argument.
One or the other. You were guessing anyway. Aubrey Huff and Carlos Lee are our next two.
Great. Very clear here. Neither one of them a Hall of Famer. Carlos Lee wasn't in very good physical shape for most of his career. And you just can't, he didn't look good in the uniform. So you can't have that. You don't want to sully. The Hall of Fame is a sacred place.
It's a
sacred place. And when you think of the Hall of Fame, you think of Joe DiMaggio.
Right.
You know, you think of Ted Williams, the fighter pilot. You think of Mickey Mantle. You think of Ted Klazuski and his, his high sleeves there. Carlos Lee, he just doesn't look like a Hall of Famer to me. He just is like, I mean, sure, he was a fine hitter, but it's a little portly. He was a little thick around the middle. And you just, you know what I mean? You just can't have guys like that in the Hall of Fame. It's just unseemly. And so I say no. And then Aubrey Huff, I mean, what a ding-dong this guy is. No, I don't know. I mean, he was a good player, but boy, oh boy, just a grade A ding-dong this guy. So just on for political reasons, I'm just choosing to say no.
By the way, the great thing about that is obviously the lack of facts and you putting Ted Klazuski in the Hall of Fame. Just decided you were going to put him in the Hall of Fame.
In my mind... I don't like the reality of this is unimportant to me. In my mind, he's in the Hall of Fame.
By the way,
like,
he should be. Not. I mean, he was a great player. He was a very fine player. It was a very short career. He should be just because it sounds so much better when you say DiMaggio and Klazuski. You know, that just makes the Hall of Fame sound so much more authoritative. What the heck's going on with Aubrey Huff? What's going on in that mind of his?
You know, it's probably best we not even guess.
that is probably a fair point. All right. How about his
good hitter, though? Aubrey Huff, very good. Underrated hitter because he played in Tampa Bay for a long time.
He was a really good hitter.
Very good hitter, that guy. But not a Hall of Famer.
No, he's not a Hall of Famer. But he was. He really was a good hitter. I you know, in doing this, it's fun to go back and look at some of these guys that are better than you remembered. I mean, I kind of remembered Aubrey Huff as sort of the mascot kind of, you know, he was still pretty good with the Giants, but he was more of a mascot-y type player at that point. And you go back to some of those years in Tampa Bay, they're good. I mean, they're some of these guys like that are not going to the Hall of Fame had two or three or more Hall of Fame seasons, you know?
Yeah, well, we're now at the point where these guys who are on the ballot played through the era, the offensive explosion era, you know, like all those guys are now up for consideration. So you're going to get these guys like Carlos Lee. Carlos Lee had almost 400 home runs or something, 350 home runs. Yeah. I mean, these are like, these are very good numbers these guys have, and they're not going to sniff the Hall of Fame. Like, yeah, no one who has 358 home runs is like an automatic into the Hall of Fame, but if you just looked at his stats, I mean, Carlos Lee is going to have better stats than a lot of Hall of Famers.
Right. No, and I wrote that. I wrote that his stats are almost identical to Orlando Cepeda, who is in the Hall of Fame. So,
right. You
know, crazy. Of course, they're very different. I mean, even though the stats are similar, because of the time, they weren't equal players or even close to equal players. But
right.
Still amazing. All right. What about Hideki Matsui? There's a Yankee for you.
Oh, easy Hall of Famer. Easy. Wore the pinstripes. You know what? He wore the pinstripes. That's one thing. He was a key part of a number of, you know, great Yankee teams. He was a very feared hitter. I didn't do any research, guy. How feared you were. He was a very feared hitter from the left side of the plate. He's very patient at the plate. That 2003 team that made the series, the 2004 team that I don't remember what happened to them, but they in both he was on both of those teams, and he was always like a guy you didn't want to see up in the big spot. He also had, I assume, a career in a different country that was probably really good. Again, I'm not doing any research, and I believe there's also a great story about him having a very large pornography collection. Yeah.
Yes.
Again, I only have a vague memory of it, and I'm not going to look it up because I promised myself I wouldn't do any research. But I remember the story being he had like a vintage pornography collection that he was neither ashamed of nor reticent to discuss.
Oh, no, and he was fully proud of it, and would actually at times simply bring it up to reporters. They didn't even ask.
He seems like a very enlightened guy, a very progressive person. So you know what? I'm going to say Hall of Famer.
What? Hideki, what was the pitch you hit the home run on? Did I tell you about my porn collection?
I don't remember. I think it was a changeup. But listen, let me tell you about my pornography collection.
Hideki Matsui was an amazing player in Japan, obviously. And, you know, that's where he got the Godzilla nickname, which I did. Of course, I am, as research guy, can tell you, he got the Godzilla nickname not for his power, even though he did have tremendous power in Japan. He had 50 home runs one year. He got it because of his skin condition when he was young. It's like it was like a cruel nickname by kids.
Oh, that's so much less fun.
I know, but then he embraced it and loved it. So, and he, by the way, seems like, porn collection aside, seems like one of the all-time great guys. Like just somebody who never seemed to want to cause problems for anybody. Just a great, great guy. He's not going to the Hall of Fame, but I have said, and I do believe this, there should be an international Hall of Fame. I mean, right now the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown does not acknowledge international play. I mean, it does in the museum, but not in the, and I think it should. I think Setahara Oh ought to be in the Hall of Fame. And I think Hideki Matsui, when you combine their careers, you can make a good argument for the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
All right. Kerry Wood and Kevin Millwood.
This is very easy call here. Kerry Wood, obvious Hall of Famer.
Obvious.
Struck out 20 guys in a game. you know, right there, that's most of what you need to get into the Hall of Fame.
What percentage does that get him into the Hall of Fame? What percentage?
That's like he gets halfway there just with that. Because like, how many guys have ever done that? Well, one other guy, right?
Who's not in the Hall of Fame? 50%.
But also, here's what it is with Kerry Wood. This is the Sandy Koufax thing, right? It's like potential. Like, yeah, he was hampered by injuries, and he was limited, and he kept getting hurt over and over again. But like, if you look at his potential, what he could have been the greatest pitcher of all time.
Sure.
And so, given that, you got to put him in because of potential. Millwood, he doesn't quite get in for me. He was on those Braves teams that underachieved, you know, like they only won one World Series and whatever. They won 15 straight division titles. They only won one World Series. So basically everyone on those teams is very suspect to me.
So you wouldn't put any of them in?
They didn't get enough rings, man. You know, like,
show me the rings.
Like, show me the rings, Kevin Millwood. How many rings do you have? Like, they won every year, and they couldn't get over that hump. And I blame not only him, but everyone equally.
So you would take Maddux and Smoltz and Glavine out of the hall?
Yeah, I think I would. Well, I wouldn't take them out, but if they were up now, I would vote against them, of course. Yeah, not enough rings. So
the thing I would say is amazing is that Kevin Millwood was a good pitcher. Kevin Millwood was a good pitcher. Kerry Wood, as you mentioned, certainly was at times terrific, but as a career, you know, because of the injuries and all that, nobody remembers Kevin Millwood. I mean, Kerry Wood, everybody remembers Kerry Wood. Nobody remembers Kevin Millwood. And they're pretty similar, you know, as far as their career accomplishments or whatever the case may be. But this is how baseball is. That's one thing I don't like. Well, there are numerous things I don't like, but that's one of the things I don't like about Hall of Fame, the way a lot of people look at the Hall of Fame. It's like, well, this guy's in. Nobody's the same. Nobody, you know, when you look at the two people, even if they have the same exact numbers, the way they did it was different. The context is different. Everything is different. So you look at Kevin Millwood, you look at Kerry Wood. I mean, Kevin Millwood, not that interesting career, really. Kerry Wood, fascinating career. Absolutely fascinating career, you know. So it's just a little something. All right. How about here's one for you. Orlando Hudson.
O-Dog.
O-Dog.
O-Dog. Easy call here, Hall of Famer. O-Dog. just
the nickname.
This guy. Well, first of all, the nickname gets you halfway there, right?
Right.
O-Dog, a great fielder, a truly slick fielding second baseman.
He was slick. He won
four gold gloves. How many people have ever won four gold gloves? How many? Literally, in the history of baseball, how many people have won four gold gloves? I'll tell you, no one else. He's the only man to ever do it. He hit 300 in 2008 with the Diamondbacks. So he was a great hitter. We know that from that piece of information. By the way, I'm betraying myself. I'm now doing research.
But the sort of research I would expect you to do, sort of the casual glancing research that is worth it.
O-Dog in his career, 85 stolen bases, 28 caught stealing. Who has ever had a better ratio than that in the history of the game? I'll tell you, no one. Top ratio of all time, stolen bases to caught stealing for a career. It's easy. Easy call. Slick fielding second baseman, four gold gloves, two-time All-Star, hit 300. Hall of Famer.
Hall of Famer. By the way, slick fielding is really something cool. If that is the description on the back of your podcast baseball card, slick fielding, second baseman or whatever, that's as good as it gets.
Who's going to beat that? Yeah. That's amazing.
Who's going to beat that?
An amazing.
All right, so here's a question for you. It was an amazing career for O-Dog. Here's a question for you about O-Dog in general. O-Dog was one of the very few baseball players who actually did chatter on the field, like actual hey, bada, bada chatter on the field. I don't think he said hey, bada, bada, but he was famous for never shutting up when he was out there on the field.
Great.
Where do you stand on that? Where do you stand on chatter in Major League games?
Were you on the fence about whether or not Orlando Hudson should be in the Hall of Fame? If you were, you're now firmly in my camp, because that is Hall of Fame behavior. That's team leadership. That is positive attitude. That is throwback. That is a throwback to an earlier time that we can all celebrate. Come on, you got it. That now I expect a unanimous vote.
Leon Hernandez and Chris Carpenter and Carlos Zambrano. I'm going to throw all three of them in there.
Whoa.
Let's throw all three right-handers of their time, all of about similar value. Leon Hernandez, Chris Carpenter, and Carlos Zambrano. Who's going in?
Easy call here. All three Hall of Famers. Leon Hernandez. What do you need to know? First of all, he had a winning record in his career. That's a key.
He did.
By one game. He was 178 and 177. but the reason Levon gets in is very obviously the clinching game against the Braves, right? Struck out 16.
Right.
Now, did Forrest Gregg's strike zone in that game extend from the outer edge of each batter's box across the plate to the outer edge of the far batter's box? Yes, it did. Is that Leland Hernandez's fault? No. Did he strike out 16 guys and clinch the NLCS for the Marlins? Yes, he certainly did. Big game pitcher. That's all you need to know about Leland Hernandez. Big game pitcher with a 95 career ERA plus. Let's just ignore that. Big game pitcher, Leland Hernandez, Hall of Famer. Chris Carpenter. Now we're back at the Kerry Wood thing. It's potential. It's all potential with Chris Carpenter. Lots of injuries for Chris Carpenter, but if he hadn't been injured, what kind of guy could he have become? We'll never know, but it could have been great. And then Zambrano is easy Hall of Fame call for one simple reason: great hitting pitcher, right? That's the thing everybody knows about Zambrano. Great, good pitcher, very good pitcher. 120 career ERA plus. That's pretty good. Through almost 2,000 innings, which I think is the most innings any pitcher's ever thrown. in baseball history, but he could mash. The guy could mash. I mean, how do you put a price tag on that? How do you not put Zambrano right into the Hall of Fame based on that alone?
He could mash. I mean, there is no question he could mash. I went back, by the way, and looked at some of the strike calls in that Leon Hernandez.
It's game. Amazing, isn't it? There's YouTube videos where you can watch them all in a row, and it is shocking.
It's shocking. It really is shocking, especially now, where if a ball is like a third of an inch outside and the umpire calls it a strike, we all have like a Twitter fit and we just go insane. What is this guy even watching? I mean, how could he not call that 100-mile-an-hour fastball a third of an inch outside a strike? What is he saying? You know, these balls are 2.5-3 feet outside consistently.
And it's truly shocking. Yeah.
Some of them look like they are actually 5 feet outside and they kind of broke in to 2 feet outside. And then
the final pitch of the game, the called strike three to McGriff, is it's like eye level and 18 inches outside. It's one of the worst calls I've ever seen in my life. Now, here's the thing. You feel really bad watching that for the Braves.
Yes.
But then you watch a compilation of strike calls that were given to Greg Maddux
and
Tom Glavine in that same era, and you're like, oh, okay, it's fine. Like there are whole games where Maddux is just throwing that sort of that tailing whatever two seamer that he threw, the one that if you were a right hander, it started outside and felt right, like a changeup motion. That bends back toward the plate. I mean, they are Javi Lopez would be set up outside in the batter's box, and he would just hit the target every time, and they would call strike three. And it's like they paid for it karmically. They paid for it in that game with Leland Hernandez.
Well, I've said that. Braves fans who have said they complained about that game, I'm like, look, you're not wrong. But I got to tell you, Tom Glavine did not throw a strike in Game 6 against Cleveland in the 1995 World Series. He didn't throw a single strike in the entire game.
Just
at some point, he's like, I don't have to. I do not have to throw a strike. Really weird. It's weird that because only certain guys, other people, the strike zone was tiny. Just like, you know, that was part of the power thing. And we all know about the steroids and the weightlifting and all that. But part of it is the strike zone was ridiculously small. And you had to go into the hitter's zones in order to get strikes. Except for a few guys, most of them Braves, who just got incredible calls outside of the zone. It's just insane. Just insane. All right. And then let's go with the lefty, Jamie Moyer.
Yes.
Jamie Moyer.
First ballot Hall of Famer, Jamie Moyer. first of all, the word that comes to mind is longevity. You're going to say longevity.
Yes.
He pitched, I believe he pitched until he was 71 years old.
71, he
won, no joke, he won 269 games. There probably aren't that many people in the Hall of Fame who won more games than he did. Now, it should be noted, those 269 games, he won 8 games a year for 40 years. But, I mean, he 4,000 innings, the most innings anyone has ever thrown in the history of baseball. There's no one else. The only person who's thrown the same number is Carlos Imbrano, who threw 2,000. Don't question my math on this. Longevity, crafty lefty, the greatest crafty lefty of all time. The traditional thinking about the Hall of Fame is if someone is the best that there has ever been at a position, you got to put that person in. Well, guess what? Who is a better crafty lefty than Jamie Moyer? No one. Hall of Famer.
No one. Craftiest. The craftiest lefty of all time. Just super duper crafty. I do love his career. I love Jamie Moyer's career in so many ways. I love that he, you know, basically from the day – there's I wrote the piece, obviously, about Jamie Moyer. And the thing that struck me was when Moyer was in high school, he was – dominant. He was a dominant high school pitcher, as almost all eventual major league pitchers are. So he was dominant, and all he cared about baseball was, you know, that was his entire life, and he fully expected to get drafted, and he didn't get drafted at all. I don't think anybody even considered drafting him. And he was like the big hero in the town. So when he did not get drafted, the local paper wrote a story asking scouts, like, oh, how in the world could you pass up on Jamie Moyer? And one scout who, you know, said, oh, well, you know, he might still get drafted. He just needs to get a little faster. You know, they're saying that in high school. And I just thought that was awesome that at 18 years old, Jamie Moyer had to look in the mirror and say, oh, this is I'm Jamie Moyer. That's who I'm going to be. I think at that point he was like, I'm going to be Steve Carlton. It's like, no, you're going to kind of have to be a crafty Jamie Moyer for the next 45 years of your life. So great career for Jamie Moyer. All right. Now let's go with some guys that are going to be a little tougher for you, because these are guys that some people actually think should be in the Hall of Fame. So from here on in, here we go. Omar Vizquel.
Yeah. Hall of Famer. Easy call here. Hall of Famer. He played in almost 3,000 games.
Which is a record.
Number of games anyone has ever played in Major League Baseball. he had more than 10,000 at-bats. He scored 1,400 runs. He had nearly 3,000 hits, 2,877 hits. There's only six people in the history of baseball who have had more hits than him. He's slick fielding. You want to talk about slick fielding? How about Omar Vizquel, slickest of them all? Probably one of the three greatest fielding shortstops in history. This is based on only my recollection and memory. He almost never made errors. He got to every ball. He was good to his left. He was good to his right. He hit second, I think, or first or second on that legendary Indians team. That crazy offense that scored 1,000 runs.
Sure.
Should I keep going? Have I not made a convincing argument for Omar Vizquel as a Hall of Famer? It's absurd. Of course he's a Hall of Famer.
Not troubled in the least by that 82 OPS plus, are you?
What are you talking about? What's OPS plus?
I'm telling you, Omar Vizquel is going to be the controversial guy for the next 10 years. He's going to be the Jack Morris, I think, of the next 10 years. I do. I think there are people that feel very, very, very strongly that he belongs. There are going to be people that feel very, very strongly that he doesn't belong. And he's going to ride that sort of really unfair. I didn't want that for Jack Morris. I mean, Jack Morris has gotten in now. Jack Morris is in the Hall of Fame. But he didn't deserve that. He didn't deserve 15 years of people just picking his career apart. Right. I mean, that's not right.
I mean, he kind of deserved it in that he made an issue of it every year. Like he got it.
Yeah, he didn't shy
away from that. He didn't say like, hey, everyone, I just want to be left alone. He like was campaigning for himself all the time. So I kind of think he does deserve people picking over his career a little bit, but whatever.
Well, I think Omar Vizquel will also campaign somewhat for himself. Omar, you know, look, terrific fielder. Got a lot of hits. I didn't vote for him. All right. Johnny Damon.
Easy call here. Easy call. Hall of Famer. Johnny Damon. First of all, just the grand slam and the two run homer in game 7 of the 2004 ALCS. That alone gets you.
What percentage?
That gets you 50% of the way there. That big game, that gets you 50% of the way there. He played in 2,500 games in his career. It's the most in Major League Baseball history. He had almost 2,800 hits. He had 408 stolen bases. He walked more than 1,000 times. He had a career 352 on base percentage. He was the leadoff hitter of some of the best offenses in history. He played center field. It's a hard position. He had long flowing hair. That was a memorable thing about him that should get you another 20% of the way to the Hall of Fame. So I say Johnny Damon, easy call, Hall of Famer.
Those 408 stolen bases.
It's the most in history. Yeah. Number one in history.
Most in history. I think that's a record. Johnny Damon, by the way, it's hard to believe he's been retired for 5 years, but he has. I would say 7 or 8 years ago, there was, I don't know exactly what I would describe it as, but there was like a sense of tension in the baseball sort of Hall of Fame voting community because it sure as heck looked like
it sure did.
At that point, right? It did. And all of a sudden, there was like this weird, like, well, if he gets 3,000 hits, that's kind of a Hall of Fame like thing. He's got to go to the Hall of Fame, and I don't want to put him in the Hall of Fame. And it was like this sort of weird back and forth, and he ended up falling short. But it reminded me of in the 80s, there was sort of the same thing with 400 home runs back then, which is hard to believe. But every player who had 400 home runs was in the Hall of Fame. And right. Dave Kingman hit his 400th home run. And there was like this, what do we do? Dave Kingman has 400 home runs. Everybody has 400 home runs. This is the Hall of Fame. What are we supposed to do here? What are we supposed to do? And they were able to solve the problem by just not voting him into the Hall of Fame. That was a fairly easy way to handle it. So I suspect they would have done the same thing with Johnny Damon.
Well, after Damon's age 37 season, he had more than 2,700 hits, and he had been averaging more than 150 a year for four straight years. Yeah. So it seemed like, all right, by the time he's 40, like he'll hang on and he'll have 3,000 hits. And it would have been hard. I mean, like he had over 500 doubles.
Yeah,
he had, you know, he could hit for power occasionally. He had 400 stolen bases.
No, there are numbers you can put together with him that put him in a very, very elite group. If you put together his stolen bases and his hits and his doubles and his runs scored, I think. And it's like,
yeah, he had nine straight years of scoring 100 runs in the middle of his career. And then a 10th later on, like, yeah, he was going to build a case with three more decent years that were like, you know, tail end of your career years. He would have had a very good argument.
Yeah, I think he would have gotten kind of the Craig Biggio thing. I think he would have kind of gotten in, sort of sneaking in, because he would have had the 3,000 hits as sort of his baseline. Plus one of the all-time great characters in the game, right? Yeah. I mean, just one of the all-time great characters. All right, here's a very tough one. I don't know if I'm going to get, you know, which version of you I'm going to get for this, but what do you do with Johan Santana?
Easy call here, Hall of Fame. now, the tragedy of Santana is the injuries, but you already know how I feel about this. When any player has a career shortened by injuries, you credit that player with what he would have accomplished using your imagination and extending his career. So, that's, you know, the last full year Johan Santana pitched, he was 31. That's insane. Like, he pitched one more year. He was out of baseball in 2011. He came back in 2012, had one more year, but it wasn't a full season. It was sort of he threw 117 innings. But when he after his age 31 season, this guy was a Hall of Famer. This guy was heading towards the Hall of Fame. Yeah. He led the league in so many things so many times. He led the league in starts, ERA three times. He led the league in wins once. He led the league in strikeouts 3 years in a row. He led the league in ERA plus and FIP and whip and hits per nine innings 3 years in a row, whip 4 years in a row. Like, this guy was a Hall of Fame pitcher. He also always came up huge in the playoffs, and I don't want you to check my data on that. I just know for a fact that he always came up huge in the playoffs and always won. Yeah.
Huge, especially
against
the Yankees.
That's true. I don't want to look it up, but I'm sure that's true. But the fact is that as a career, he last pitched at age 31, and then injuries just completely derailed him. But I am using the rule that I'm allowed to use because I made it up, which is that I then just extend mentally his career into what he could have been, and then I credit him with all of those stats, and then I announce that he's a Hall of Famer.
I like it. Well, then I'm going to throw two at you right now. Billy Wagner and Trevor Hoffman, and there's a reason I'm throwing them out there with you.
And what reason is that, I wonder?
You don't have any idea what it could be.
All right.
Billy Wagner and Trevor Hoffman.
Billy Wagner, easy call, Hall of Famer. One of the most feared pitchers in baseball. You already know how I feel about fear. He was incredibly feared. He was left-handed, which is cool. There aren't that many left-handed closers. He threw really hard. He had his career whip was under one. He had 422 saves, which is tops in MLB history. He only gave up this. My favorite stat about him, by the way, is he gave up 601 hits in 903 innings, which is an incredibly, it's almost exactly, two hits every three innings, which is such a wonderful thing. Like if he'd just given up one more hit, it would have been perfect. But you know, what else do you need? So feared that guy, nobody more feared than him. And I mean, it goes without saying, if you look at his statistics, which, you know, I don't like to do, but if you look at his statistics, he was an all-star. Basically, he was an all-star when he was 27, and he was an all-star again when he was 38. I mean, who else? That's the longest spread in baseball history. No one else has ever accomplished that. So, yeah, Billy Wagner, easy call, I would say. Easy call, Hall of Fame. And then Trevor Hoffman. I mean, what do you need to know about Trevor Hoffman? Do you know how many saves Trevor Hoffman had in his career? 601. Number one. Number one in history. Number one all time. Wow. Yeah. You know, I mean, this guy here's a crazy stat about Trevor Hoffman that I just made up. You know how many hits he gave up off his changeup in his career, in his entire career?
His whole career off of his changeup.
1,000 innings. How many hits do you think Trevor Hoffman gave up in his career off his changeup? How many do you think?
I don't know.
The answer is going to shock you. The answer is like 40.
Wow. Like 40 hits? Yeah. That's wow.
That's the actual answer is like 40. Yeah, I think, again, I don't know. But yeah, no, there's no question. Trevor, 600 saves, career whip, just over one. What do you want from me? Easy call, Hall of Fame.
Why would I bring up these two right after I brought up Johan Santana? This is a very interesting point. Trevor Hoffman is going to get elected this year, and I think it'll be a delightful day when he does get elected. He's a wonderful soul, was a great pitcher, great closer. His Hell's Bells thing was super awesome and love it and love this guy. So I'm thrilled for him.
Great.
Billy Wagner is not going to get elected to the Hall, despite your excellent case for him. By the way, this is true. I'm going to give you a true fact about him. That .998 whip of his is the lowest since Deadball. It is the lowest whip of any pitcher since Deadball. So there's a little Billy Wagner. Yeah, about that. The Billy Wagner people, and I know they're out there, have done a very poor job of promoting that part of his case. To me, you throw that out there. I mean, just push it. You know, there's actually, even in Deadball, there was only one guy who had a better whip than him. So it feels to me like that would be something you'd push. Again, Billy Wagner probably not going to get in the Hall of Fame. Johan Santana is going to fall off the ballot this year. I don't see how you can make the argument that Trevor Hoffman or Billy Wagner was a better pitcher than Johan Santana.
No way.
I just don't see how you can make that argument. I really don't. And yet, this is where we are because of the roles they played. And look, the roles are important. But because of the roles they played, you know, Billy Wagner is going to stay on the ballot. Trevor Hoffman is going to go into Hall of Fame. And Johan Santana is going to be retired to some, you know, whatever the non-Hall of Fame ballad in the sky is, I guess. It just,
you know, what's,
it makes no sense.
You know what's crazy about Billy Wagner is he had one weakness as a pitcher, which is that he was a little wild. He, in his career, walked three guys per nine innings, which is not a very good number for a closer. But he was so unhittable that his whip was still the lowest of any pitcher since the Deadball era. That's how impossible it was to get a hit off the guy. He gave up six hits per nine innings. That's ridiculous. That's like, if you have one season where you hit that number, you're thrilled. And he did that for his career over 900 innings. Like it's shocking when you see that. He gave up three walks per nine innings as a closer and still, first of all, had a 12. He had a 12 strikeouts per nine innings and had a .998 whip. That's absurd. I mean, you obviously make the argument. The argument you make is purely based on his on the role he played. But if you had one inning, if you had to bring someone in for one inning, you would definitely bring in Wagner over Hoffman. And if you had to pitch any of the three of them in any scenario in their prime, you probably pick Santana, right? Like he was.
I think you would never trade Santana for either of the other two.
No,
in his prime. You wouldn't probably wouldn't trade him for both of them. I mean, and that's it's not a knock. That's just the roles that they played. But if I had to put them in order, and again, I want to make this clear, I think it's going to be great when Trevor Hoffman goes to the Hall of Fame. I'm not in any way against his case. I get it. I understand it. But he's the third best Hall of Fame case of those three guys, in my view. I really think that's true. But that's the way it is. That's where we're going to go. All right, Andrew Jones. Where are you on Andrew Jones?
Pretty obvious here, Hall of Famer. Andrew Jones.
And Huff and Aubrey Huff.
Everybody else is in.
Everybody else
Andrew Jones. Okay, a couple of things about Andrew Jones. Number one, great fielding center fielder. Unbelievable fielding center fielder. Made the majors when he was 19. Sure. How many other people have done that? I'll tell you, zero. No one's ever made it, I don't think. Hit 50 home runs one year. Was on that 96 team that they were up 2-0 in the World Series over the Yankees. I'm pretty sure they won. I don't remember what happened there. But an unbelievable center field gold glove, multiple gold gloves. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 gold gloves for Andrew Jones.
That's a record, isn't it?
I think it's – I can't imagine anybody has more than 10. 400 home runs. 150 stolen bases. That's crazy. In 152 stolen bases, it was caught 60 times, man. Stop trying to steal, Andrew. but also, we career cut short by injury. And so you know the rule. We get to now extend his career into the future and extrapolate, give him whatever credit we want to give him for anything. And so I'm going to give him another 66 home runs, get him up to 500. I'll give him another, I'll give him another 400 hits or something.
I like that.
Easy call.
Yeah, I like the adding as many home runs as necessary to get him to 500. I think that seems fair. Cool way of spelling Andrew, by the way. I've thought in numerous times since then, everybody should spell Andrew that way. That's a cooler way to spell Andrew.
See, I've had the opposite thought. I've had no one should ever spell it that way.
Andrew Jones is creating a bit of a stir because by this, and I know you've not heard of this, but by this statistic that they use for WAR, wins above replacement, the defensive component of that contends that there's a reasonable chance he's the greatest center fielder in the history of the game defensively. And the feeling seems to be that if he is the greatest defensive center fielder ever, and he has 400 plus home runs, you got to put him in the Hall of Fame. So that is an argument that is being waged out there in the wilds of baseball Hall of Fame. Huh. So yeah, it's kooky. It's kind of nutty.
Do you think you should start now saying whether you think whether you believe these people?
I did not vote for him. I did think very hard about voting for him. I basically had one free vote as far as I'm concerned. There were nine guys on this thing that I felt like I had to vote for and was definitely going to vote for. So there was one free spot. I did not give it to Andrew Jones. But I see the argument. I don't know that he's the greatest defensive center fielder ever. I think the stats are shaky, largely because you judge his defense way different than you judge, say, Willie Mays or Gary Maddox or Curt Flood or one of the other great defensive center fielders. So you judge him differently. I mean, he was great. He was definitely a great defensive center fielder. Was he that great? Like to the point where, like Ozzie Smith, you just have to put him in because he's so much better than everybody else? I don't know. I don't see it. I would love for him to stay on the ballot so that his case can be really explored. I don't know if that's going to happen or not, but he did not get my vote.
All right.
So we'll discuss that point. Let's go to Sammy Sosa.
Yeah. Easy call. Hall of Famer. Swinging.
No, I like this. What I like about this is no fat guy is not a steroid guy. He doesn't care about steroids.
Oh, I forgot. No fact, I forgot about the he took steroids. No, this is an easy call. It's 600 home runs. That's all you need to know. 600 home runs. And beginning and end of case. You hit 600 home runs, you get in the Hall of Fame. Played with a lot of joy in his heart, ran out to right field, pointed at the crowd, got him psyched up. Swing at Sammy Sosa. MVP. There's another thing. You win the MVP, guess what? You belong in the Hall of Fame.
All MVPs belong in the Hall of Fame.
Yes, yes. I mean, you're the best player. That's the what do you want? 400 total bases twice. Who else has done that in history? No one. First time in MLB history. Yeah.
Sammy Sosa did, in fact, have the greatest 5-year run of home run hitting in baseball history. He had 60 home runs 3 times during a 5-year stretch. And then, here's a cool little baseball fact for you, no fact, man. He led the league in home runs twice, but none of the years that he hit 60-plus home runs, which is
No fact guy likes that fact.
Isn't that a good stat?
That's a very good stat, yeah.
Fun, kooky stat. The thing I'd say about Sammy Sosa is his entire case is the home runs. That's right. That's his whole case. And you can make a very good argument that if that's his whole case, it's good enough. I mean, he nobody hit home runs. During that 5-year stretch, nobody has ever hit home runs like that, ever. Even McGuire, even Bonds, even Mays, Mantle, Ruth, nobody's ever hit home runs quite like that he did those 5 years. The rest of the case, though, just is not – I just don't think, because of the way the offensive era was in the 90s, I just don't think home runs are enough. I think you've got to bring a little more to the table than just home runs, and he really kind of didn't. So super duper close. Another guy I thought very hard about it, but he also did not get my 10th vote. So,
all right. I mean, you're wrong. You're obviously wrong.
But I've been wrong about so many of these guys since I haven't picked one yet that I voted for. Fred McGriff, where are you on Fred McGriff?
Fred McGriff doesn't get in.
Oh, poor crime dog.
I'm sorry. Doesn't get in. Doesn't not good enough. I'll tell you why. Not enough rings. How many rings does Fred McGriff have?
I don't know the answer to that, actually, off the top of my head.
I'll tell you how many. Zero. Now, don't check me on this. I'm not sure if he was on the team. Oh, he was on the team in 95. All right, fine. He has one ring. One ring. You think that's enough to get it to make the Hall of Fame? Sorry, buddy. You have a career, 19-year career. You need more than one ring. Just straight up. No more argument.
But Sammy Sosa had no rings. You just said Sammy Sosa.
Yeah, but he ran out to right field and pointed at the crowd and got them all psyched up. Did McGriff do that? No.
Did the Tom Emanski commercials.
That gets him about 50% of the way there. Honestly, that is one of the things that is a huge checkmark in his favor is the Tom Emanski commercials. The other thing is I believe he had the exact same number of home runs as Lou Gehrig. Isn't that correct? 493.
That is correct, fat guy. Yeah. That is.
Yeah. Non-fact guy knows some facts. So those two things get him like 65% of the way there, but he can't quite get over the edge because not enough rings.
Right.
Didn't play with a lot of flair. Right. He was a pretty like quiet guy. Wasn't a team leader because he wasn't demonstrative when he played, which is a huge strike against him. That reduces him about 20%. His argument is that he wasn't demonstrative. Didn't get to 500 home runs. Didn't get to that magic number. You know, I don't know what to tell you, buddy. Like, you got to hit some of these benchmarks. It's just numbers. It's just math. Sorry. Doesn't get in. Sorry, Graham Dog.
Poor crime dog. Poor crime dog. I wrote today. Today my Fred McGriff piece ran today, and I mentioned in there. I think we've actually discussed this. So that commercial, that truck commercial, where the truck says the truck doesn't say anything, but the narrator says that the truck is they're not just raising the bar. They are the bar, right? You've seen those commercials, yeah. That's just stupid. It makes no sense. You don't want to be the bar.
No, it's a terrible ad because the bar is considered the thing that is the minimum allowable amount of something, right? You have to get over the bar in order to not fall short of what is required to gain admission into whatever club you're trying to get into. So, yeah, you don't want to be the bar. You want to be 50 levels above the
bar. Way above the bar. Way above the bar. And you don't want to just raise the bar. You want to be way above the bar. So basically what they're saying is, we are absolutely the bare minimum, and you should buy us for that. I mean, that's basically what the truck people are saying. So I think it's really stupid. However, I do think, and I've now come to this full conclusion, Fred McGriff is the bar. He is the Hall of Fame bar. You can make a tremendously strong argument for him. You can make a tremendously strong argument not for him. He was an all-time Hall of Fame type hitter. He did not add anything else really to his case beyond that. He wasn't a great base runner. He wasn't a great defensive player. He played first base, whatever. He's the bar. He's the bar. I could make the argument for, I could make the argument against. I honestly, if I had enough votes, I'd vote him in. He's a guy that if I had enough votes, I would vote him in because I think he's so on the line. Plus, he's so cool. I mean, the mustache alone is enough to that adds points. That mustache adds points.
Mustache gets him like 40% of the way there.
That's huge. Mustache plus Emanski plus Lou Gehrig home runs equals 97%.
Yeah, but then he has things taken away. He has percentages taken away for not winning enough rings and not being demonstrative enough on the field.
But what about the little bat swing where like the bat would like come flying over his head? Like
that was pretty cool. That was cool, yeah. Cool. He had 30 home runs and 103 RBIs when he was 38 playing for the Cubs. I mean, it's just ridiculous how consistent that guy was.
He was. It's funny because you compare him to Eddie Murray and the nickname Steady Eddie, but really McGriff was even worse steady than Eddie Murray was, which is crazy. All right. What do you think about Jeff Kent? Where are you on Jeff Kent?
I was going to say easy call Hall of Fame, but I'll go the other way and say not Hall of Fame. And again, I have that ability because this is based on nothing, right?
Because
things that get him 50% of the way there include mustache, great mustache.
He
played second base. He wasn't a particularly slick fielding second baseman, but he was like a power hitting second baseman, which is the next best thing to being a slick fielding second baseman. He was given an MVP award because everybody hated Barry Bonds. So that's kind of a cool thing. He was gifted an MVP award in 2000 when he absolutely wasn't even close to being the best player on his team, like within 70% of points of just because everyone hated Bonds. That's cool. But you know, he was a little bit of a jerk. He was, remember he was like in an ATV accident or something and he broke his arm and there was some clause in his contract. Isn't this Jeff Kent that he was told like if he was ATVing and it would violate the terms of the contract. So he lied and said he wasn't ATVing. Am I making this up or did this happen?
I have no memory.
I'm pretty sure this happened.
It's probably true. I'm not going to say it didn't happen.
Even if it didn't happen, it's the kind of thing that Jeff Kent would have done. So that, you know, in this day and age, that's as good a reason as any. For no reason, I'll just say not Hall of Fame.
I like it. 10th anniversary of Jeff washes his truck, the Hardball Times wrote in 2012.
Yes,
I
right.
This. So this apparently he said he was washing his truck
and slipped and fell, but really he had been ATVing, right? I didn't make it up. Tell me I didn't make it up.
You did not. You did not make it up. And that is, I had totally forgotten about that. But the truck washing thing, that's as good an excuse as you're ever going to give right there. I was washing my truck. That alone should get him to the Hall of Fame, really, if you think about it. By the way, we should have a name for the MVP awards that are clearly not given to the best player. Like you could call them like the Carl Malone Awards or something, or the Charles Barkley Awards, or the Jeff Kent Awards, where clearly they've just gotten so sick of giving the MVP award to Michael Jordan or Barry Bonds, they just like forget it. We're just going to give it to this guy. We don't care.
Yeah, that happened one year with Shaquille O'Neal and Steve Nash or something, right? Didn't that happen
Nash won a couple of MVPs.
Yeah, but I feel like there was one year when like it was obviously Shaq and then they gave it to Nash. But then there's also people who go back and say, well, actually, if you really analyze the numbers that year, Nash was better or he had, maybe his PER was higher or whatever. I don't know. But yeah, it's a fun thing. It happened. I'll tell you when it happened was the year it happened to Ted Williams like at least twice, right? DiMaggio won the year Ted Williams hit 400, DiMaggio won for his hitting streak. And then there was another year, I think Williams won the Triple Crown, didn't win because everybody hated him. I love things like that. It's great.
It really is fun. It's fun when you can give it the award. Of course, that's why LeBron doesn't win the award every year. I mean, it's just, you know, it's all well and good to give awards to other guys. That's fine. I'll take LeBron. That's fine with me. Okay, I'm going to give you one more, and then I'm going to go through the 10 people I voted for, and you can just tell me what you think about those 10 people. And we'll do it that way because we're running out of time. Gary Sheffield is the last of the people I did not vote for.
Easy call here, Hall of Famer. That's right. You know where this is going. Most feared. Most feared hitters.
Most feared.
In baseball. Maybe the most feared of his era. Truly terrifying to face him.
I was afraid.
Won a batting crown. Basically, if you win a batting crown, if you have the highest batting average in your league, you're going to get into the Hall of Fame. That's a no.
All
yeah, like it's like MVP. It's like a rubber stamp, basically. 500 home runs. There's another rubber stamp for you. He could do it all. He was not a slick fielder. I'll say that he was not a slick fielder. But he was very feared.
He was feared.
He was in a bunch of all-stars. He came in second in the MVP voting 1 year. But the feared thing gets him 50% of the way there, and then the batting title kind of pushes him over the top.
Here's what I will say about Gary Sheffield. Gary Sheffield is unquestionably one of the, 30 best hitters in baseball history, 30, 35 best hitters in baseball history. I mean, there's almost no way to knock him out of that group. Now, he obviously did admit to using the cream, I guess. Didn't he say he used the cream?
It was one of the Bonds things, I think, yeah.
Whatever the Bondsy things, which I don't, whatever. But some people feel strongly about that. Nobody has had as much of his career taken away from because of bad defense. His defensive war is like negative 24 wins or something insane. It's insane. He has like 60 war for his career, and you're like, 60 war, that puts him kind of right on the borderline of whether or not he's a Hall of Famer or not a Hall of Famer. That's interesting to discuss. And then you look, he has 80 offensive war. 80! I mean, it's like insane. He was an insane hitter who just had all of it taken away because of just terrible, terrible defense. And the thing that's frustrating is there was no reason for that guy to be a terrible. It's not like he's some big lug, just Adam Dunn type guy running around out there and can't. He was fast. He was a former shortstop. Like, that is pure, I don't care. That is pure, this is not what I do. I'm not at the plate, so I'm not interested. So, very, very difficult. Very difficult case. He did not get my vote either because he just didn't get it. He's just not. He's tremendous, tremendous hitter, but not one of the 10 for me. All right. So now I'm going to give you the 10. I'm actually giving you 11. I'm going to give you the. I'm going to put it down to the final two, and I'm going to have you guess which one I voted for. Here you go. All right. So here are the people I voted for. Number one, Jim Thome.
Hall of Famer, obvious Hall of Famer.
Obvious Hall of Famer. Chipper Jones.
Sure. Best third baseman of all time, obvious Hall of Famer. Also like to hunt. That gets him like 50% of the way there.
Does it get him 50% of the way there?
I don't know. I've heard that people are that think it's cool when dudes go hunting.
Vladimir Guerrero.
Oh, easy Hall of Famer. Obviously could hit anything. One of the best right-handed hitters of all time. Played for the Expos. That's cool. Easy call there.
He was fun, man.
The best,
man. Seriously, he was fun.
The most, if we were doing funnest players, who was more fun? Seriously, serious question. Who is more fun as a player than Vlad Guerrero?
I think if you put Vlad Guerrero on your team and Adrian Beltre on your team, that is the funnest team in baseball history. Just it doesn't even matter who the other seven are. They could be a bunch of Jeff Kents, and it would still be the funnest player, the funnest team.
Love it.
Oh my gosh, Vlad Guerrero, so fun. All right, Edgar Martinez on my ballot.
Of course, he should be. He's one of the greatest hitters of all time. This is absurd. Of course, as non-stats guy, I'm gonna say sorry. He doesn't make it. He was a DH, didn't play defense. so he doesn't, he can't make it. But as me, Mike Shore, of course, Edgar is in the Hall of Fame. It's ridiculous that he isn't.
Unbelievable. What is this DH thing? Okay, look, if you're going to put Trevor Hoffman in the Hall of Fame, all right, now I'm with you. All right, we're gonna put specialists in the Hall of Fame. That's fine. How can we put him in the Hall of Fame and not Edgar? Like, Edgar's a DH, and so that doesn't count, but we're going to put closers through 1,000 innings. That does count? That makes no sense.
It's absurd. It's deeply, deeply absurd. Edgar Martinez played all 9 innings of the games that he played in, usually.
Exactly right. All right. I did vote for Mike Mussina. He is on my ballot. Mike Mussina.
Interesting. No, not enough rings and not enough 20-game winning seasons. Doesn't get in.
Only had the one right at the end of his career.
Yeah, the That's one it. Right at the end, and that was that got him 50% of the way there. But yeah, not enough rings, and he should have won 20. Should have won 20 more than he did.
Not a great mustache either. No mustache.
No, nothing.
All right, here's one for you. A personal favorite of yours, Curt Schilling.
Oh, Curt Schilling.
I'm putting this on you. Go ahead. Tell us what you think about Curt Schilling.
Well, non-stats guy, of course he gets in. Hero, Hall of Fame, career in the postseason, unhittable in the postseason. He's basically the Robert Horry of baseball. Bloody sock, et cetera, et cetera. Game six, ALCS, whatever it was in the 2004 World Series. Made big promises, followed through on them. Actual stat guy also says yes. Didn't walk anyone. Here's a crazy stat about Curt Schilling. He threw 3,261 innings of baseball in his life. Never walked a batter.
Wow, not one batter.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? It's one of the craziest stats I think about him. Never walked a single batter in more than 30.
The Jamie Moyer thing about the 40 hits on his changeup.
No, he averaged almost a strikeout an inning, and he walked a total of 711 people in those 32. I mean, that's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous.
He wasn't a finesse guy. He was a power guy. He was a straight up fireballing power pitcher with the best control of any pitcher, basically. Right? Doesn't he have the lowest walk rate of anyone in history or something?
In history, there's some active guys. Kershaw and Kluber. There are a couple of active guys. But yeah, other than that, since 1900, he's the lowest.
I mean,
he's the lowest among people who retired. It's incredible.
Just amazing. Just incredible. I mean, when he was in the sort of like last act of his career, which you would pin as when he started with Arizona and they won the series in, the 01, 02, 03, then they won the series. And then he went to Boston. He had years where he walked, where his strikeout to walk ratio was, Here's some numbers for you. Strikeout to walk ratio is 7.5, 9.5, 6, almost 6, and 6.5. That's he's 34-39 in that span. I mean, 2002, his strikeout to walk ratio was 9.5. He struck out 316 guys and had 33 walks in 260 innings. It's not human. It's absurd. Basically, it's deeply absurd. Walk. So anyway, both non-stats guy and stats guy vote yes on Schilling, even though he's a ding dong.
Well, that's what I was going to say. And I ask of this of Michael Schur, what do you do with the ding dong part of Curt Schilling?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, like, we have this clause, right? Everyone always talks about this clause when they want to kick steroid people out, and the clause is some kind of like honorable man, gentleman clause or whatever it is about his character. But there are so many awful people already in the Hall of Fame. Like, unless you're going to go back and do an audit and kick a bunch of people out who were inveterate racists or who have admitted to using performance enhancing drugs of various kinds all throughout history, or, you know, were owners who were like pro segregation or something before the way worse crimes than being a ding dong. I mean, Schilling has done some pretty reprehensible stuff. He's passed around memes of like journalists being hanged and like stuff that's like, even in today's climate of where no one has any sense of like decorum, he's crossed the line a few times, I think. And he's now in the info wars world. Like, he's gone pretty much off the deep end. But that's not the point of the Baseball Hall of Fame. We're trying to tell the story of baseball. It's hard to tell the story of baseball from 1996 to 2008 or whatever without Curt Schilling. So I kind of think you just got to say, oh, well, he was a ding dong. And that's the deal. He was a ding dong who was really good at baseball.
Totally with you. Totally with you. You know, it's funny, because I feel like I'm very frustrated by Curt Schilling, because he is reprehensible. He really is. I mean, there's no other way to say it. He's a jerk. And yet he was an incredible pitcher. And I always felt like his great pitching was underappreciated. I always felt like he needed a champion remind people this guy was everything that people thought Jack Morris was, right? I mean, he's everything that they pretended Jack Morris was. Jack Morris had a little bit of that. He did have the great game. He was a guy that came every fifth day and he pitched hard and whatever. But he was better. He was a better version of that. Curt Schilling was. And I want to be the champion of that baseball cause. And I even wrote a piece earlier this year saying I want to be the champion of Curt Schilling baseball career because it was an incredible career. And then he did something else. I said, I'm not going to be the champion of that guy. I'll vote for him, but I'm not going to champion his case because, look, I mean, he's doing this to himself. You cannot be like an open racist scumbag and not have it like affect people's views.
The way people think
of it. So I'm going to keep voting for him and without hesitation. I don't care. I don't think any of that should have any effect on whether or not he goes to the Hall of Fame. But I think I even wrote he can find his own champion now. All right.
Maybe Alex Jones will step up.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah.
In between finding a life on Earth from outer space. All right. I voted for Roger Clemens and Barry Bonds. I voted for those two gentlemen. How does No Fact Guy feel about that?
No Fact Guy remembers a couple things about Roger Clemens. Struck out 20 in a game twice. There you go, right there.
50% of the way.
No Fact Guy also remembers the drama, the pure drama of him showing up in George Steinbrenner's box at Yankee Stadium and Susan Waldman having a connection fit, which just remains to this day one of the funniest things I have ever seen. I'm not kidding about this. I was watching that game live when that happened, and I laughed harder when hearing that than I think I can't remember now if there's a radio call or a TV call, but I've listened to it 500 times. It's funnier to me than any movie or TV show I've ever seen is Susan Waldman's reaction to a 43-year-old Roger Clemens. Like, it was like she reacted like Jesus had come to Earth and was like, "Hey everyone, I'm bringing peace throughout the land." It's so funny. It's so deeply funny. And it was like, it was a sort of apotheosis of the sort of like Yankees nation being blind to its own absurdities at that time. And I just love it so much. I mean, that alone, like 20 strikeouts twice and the Susan Waldman's reaction to when Clemens came out of retirement for like the 40th time, that gets him in. And Bonds, you know, I mean, the home run off Percival in the 2002 World Series alone gets you 50% of the way there. So, and I would – no stats guy, but for both of those guys.
Those for both of those guys. I think we bring this up every year, but we must bring it up every year. The bat throw against Piazza is still – it's and not – the bat throw itself is just – first of all, it's incredibly – violent and horrifying.
Yeah.
But the explanation afterward is to me still one of the all time great moments in baseball. I thought it was the ball. That's better than the washing truck thing, right? I thought it was the ball. I did a whole column where I pretended to be Roger Clemens' brain and how the brain was responding to that, where the brain was like going, "Oh, the ball is coming to me. I need to throw it as hard as I can into the path of Mike Piazza for reasons that I must do that." You know, I mean, it was just
right.
It's the
the thought process went like this: I'm a professional baseball player.
Right.
I'm throwing a pitch. Oh, look, the ball has been hit back towards me. I know what to do. I'm a professional baseball player. I'm going to pick up the ball and throw it as hard as I can at the feet of the man who hit it to me. Now, the reason this makes sense is because, and then that's where the thought process stopped. He suddenly realized, oh, it wasn't the ball, and then,
It's just crazy, and it's like, also, this is the oddest shaped ball
happened to the ball.
I can't get my hand around the ball. All right, there's no point in discussing Barry Bonds. Other than how often, and I believe I ask you this question as well every year, how often do you go to Baseball Reference and just look at Barry Bonds' like 2001 through 2005 seasons?
Fairly frequently. And I also go back and look at like YouTube collections of Barry Bonds' highlights because they're so wonderful. And it's like, you know, we've talked about this so many times, but the real reason that it was such a colossal bummer is because you really just wanted to believe that someone could be that good at something. And specifically baseball, the game we love. Like, you just wanted to believe that someone had gotten to the point where he had ascended into the sort of ionosphere and had figured out the game at its molecular level. And was that good? You just wanted, I wanted to believe that that was true. And that's the, you know, the, like, the scales falling from our eyes will forever be like a one of the biggest, like, sports related disappointments of my life, of like, oh yeah, of course he was cheating the whole time.
Although even as a cheater to get that good, I just, it's insane. But don't you think that's why we love the Golden State Warriors, like watching them play? It's because they're like, you know, specifically Steph and Durant, and on some days, you know, more than just those two, but certainly those two, where you're like, you want to believe that people could be that, specifically shooting the basketball. I mean, you look at Steph and you're like, well, I just never thought anybody would ever be that good at shooting a basketball.
Yes, it seems impossible. Like, it seems like, well, it's just not, it's like watching someone go to a carnival and play a carnival game, but like back up twice as far as they need to be from the place where they're like pitching the dimes into the bird baths or whatever, and just like hit like 18 in a row. You just, like, you're not supposed to be able to do that from any depth. I heard a crazy stat the other day. I think it might have been in Shea Serrano's book about basketball, that like the first year the 3-point line was in the NBA, like the person who led the league in 3-pointers hit like 35 3-pointers or something.
It's right.
Like, it's just like, that's how, what's happened to the game in the last however many years. It just wasn't a skill that anybody had because they didn't need it, right? When there's no 3-point line, and what is the every right. inch further away from the basket that you are is makes your chances of scoring go down. And now he's taken that to the next level where now there is a 3-point line, but he doesn't care. His ability to make it from 35 feet, it's roughly the same as his ability to make it from 24 feet. So why not just take it from 35 feet? Just absurd.
It's amazing. It's amazing because it really is. When the 3-point line first came into existence, I think even the best basketball players in the world were like, that's far. That's really far from the basket, yeah. Right? I mean, I wouldn't shoot out there. I mean, I guess now I will because it's worth an extra point, but generally I wouldn't be shooting from out there. And yeah, Steph doesn't get within a full body length of that 3-point line on a lot of his threes. I mean, it's insane. All right. Down the last three, Larry Walker was my ninth that I voted for. Are you a Larry Walker guy?
Yes. I can't even be non-stats guy, jokey, dumb guy about this because I believe in this cause so much. I think it's so weird. He only got 22% of the vote, right? He's not gonna make it. He's not even close, right?
No. I think he's gained some support this year, which is interesting.
Oh, that's interesting.
From the early balloting, but not enough. I mean, he's still gonna be 40% or 38% or something like that.
I mean, I feel like we talked about this last year, and he has the Colorado problem. It's a huge problem. But like,
right.
I mean, for goodness sakes, the last year he was in Montreal, he had, you know, his typical Larry Walker year. He had 44 doubles and he had a 981 OPS and that park was terrible. And he stole bases and he was had a cannon for an arm. And by the way, he hit those 44 doubles. That was 94. That was the strike year. So he would have hit like 58 doubles or something crazy. I mean, he was so good. I don't understand why there aren't more people who are. It's Colorado, right? That's just the fundamental problem of this is Colorado, and there's nothing anybody can do about it.
I think it's two things. It's two things. Colorado and the fact that he didn't play that many full seasons. He had a lot of nagging injuries that took him down some. But I've made the argument he is my cause, celeb. He is my cause, not jerk Curt Schilling. Because he is he's one of the greatest all-around players in baseball history. That's one way you should be able to get in the Hall of Fame is if you did everything well. And there are numbers that I put in the story. I would love for people to go see it that basically put him, Barry Bonds, and Willie Mays into one class of player. They're the only three players who rank top 100 in the three different categories that I was able to measure, which is batting, fielding, and base running. And he's only one of three, and the other two are, you know, forget what you think of Bonds, you know, the steroid stuff. The other two are, you know, two of the five best players in baseball history. So it's nutty, and I hope Larry Walker gets it. All right, let's end this thing by me telling you that my 10th and final vote came down to two players. One I voted for last year, one I did not. The first player is Manny Ramirez. The second player is Scott Rolen.
Ooh.
Super difficult.
I'm going to guess you didn't vote for Manny this year. I'm going to guess you voted for him last year. So I'm going to guess that you this year voted for Rolen.
Very good. You are correct. I voted, and it was super tough. As I've made very clear, I don't believe that it's fair to completely disqualify players who took steroids at a time when it was not being tested for. You can mark them down if you want, but I don't think it's fair to disqualify them. Manny failed two drug tests. Man, it's tough to overlook. I don't want to disqualify him. I don't think you can tell the story of baseball without him. He might be the greatest hitter I've ever seen in a lot of ways. I mean, obviously Bonds is in a different category. Pujols is amazing. You know, Edgar, all these other guys. But this guy was like a genius. He was just a genius of hitting and a genius in no other way. but a genius of hitting, and I love him. And I just felt like I got to help Scott Rolen stay on the ballot. I think he's in very, very severe danger of falling off the ballot. And he was a great player. Scott Rolen was a truly great player. He's another guy that the career was a little short, but there just aren't that many incredible fielding third basemen who were also, you know, as good a hitter as he was. So I gave it to Scott Rolen, did not give it to Manny. What would you have done?
I would have been like freaking out the whole time about this dumb rule that only allows you to vote for 10 of these guys, because there's about eight to serve again.
Ridiculous.
I see the point with Manny. Like he like rubbed it in your face in a way that it was like a little bit like, right, come on, dude. Like we want to be on your side, but you're not making it easy for us. I think Rolen deserves to be in. He was great. And or at least he deserves more discussion than it seems like he's getting. So I this is a totally defensible,
yes, exactly,
thing. It's just hard to not vote for Manny Ramirez when his prowess was so on display all the time. Like there were all those stories of him like taking pitches that he could have swung at to set up a pitcher for the next at bat to take it. Now, I don't think any of those stories are true, frankly. I think he was just this weird savant who just went up and saw the ball and destroyed it. And I think he was just a genius of a hitter. It comes down to nothing more complex than that. He had a gift, and he used his gift, and he also used a bunch of other stuff to make. But it would bum me out not to vote for him. But I remember hearing a story about him that when he was a kid in the Dominican Republic, he trained by stacking a bunch of tires, filling them with rocks, and then tying a rope through all of the tires and then around his waist and then like dragging it up a hill, but just like running up a hill and direct. It's like kind of just, and then he became what he became. And it's like, that's, you just want to like, why can't we just celebrate that? That's insane. That's a beautiful thing. And I mean, if it's any consolation, he has already forgotten that he played Major League Baseball. He doesn't know what the Hall of Fame is. He doesn't care one way or the other. He's like somewhere just having fun and like drinking a Mai Tai with his buddies and everything's fine. So that'll hopefully let us sleep at night for not voting for him.
Bill James insists this is true, that he would purposely get into 3-2 counts so that when the runners would be moving when he hit the ball, and so runners would score from first on doubles.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I don't know if that's true. I mean, it seems a lot like the taking a pitch so you can beat the pitcher with it later stories. But what about Manny Ramirez isn't true? It's all true. Like every crazy Manny Ramirez story you ever heard. By the way, we mentioned this last week just in passing, but you and I got to see Manny Ramirez in spring training with the Tampa Bay Rays, right?
That's right.
How much did he weigh then at that point? What do you think?
What did he weigh?
Yeah, what do you think he weighed at that
400 pounds, something like that? 410.
We saw him, the only thing I really remember is we saw him hit like a rocket line drive, because even yeah. then he could still hit. And then we watched him.
That's right. I forgot about that.
In a spring training game, we watched Manny Ramirez get picked off, and it was like, yeah, that's the way to remember him. All right, well, we have you have put in 31 okay. people into the Hall of Fame, although not Fred McGriff.
No, doesn't get in. Not enough rings.
I'm excited. I think that's fair. Not enough rings. All right. Well, this is awesome. So we'll come back next time with like a real podcast. But this is a classic, right? The Hall of Fame.
It is a classic. Well, classic is the right word. You used that word earlier, and I wanted to say that is the right word for this, for what this is. It's a classic.
It is. It's a podcast classic. All right. Well, Michael, as always, thank you.
Thanks for having me.